Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent on the scene talks about EU nations differing in the response to the tide of migrants.
The split is certainly deepening between Germany and other nations of Europe, particularly those in Eastern Europe.
We hear about what to expect at the Republican presidential debate. We look into what jobs robots may be taking in the future and look at the archiving of programs from the famous jazz host Willis Conover. It's here on The Voice of America. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is calling for a special summit to address the migrant crisis in Europe. More than 430,000 migrants fleeing the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia are reported to have crossed into the region this year. Migration watchers say nearly 3,000 people have died trying. European nations are responding differently to the flood of refugees. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez is in Munich, Germany, following the story for us and joins us now on the line. Welcome, Luis.
Hi, Susan. Well, the split is certainly deepening between Germany and other nations of Europe, particularly those in Eastern Europe, who are really not in agreement with Germany. Germany wants each country to accept 160,000 refugees per year. Some nations are saying, well, we don't have the economy or the infrastructure or the obligation to do so. Germany has threatened to push for EU sanctions against those countries that do not accept the quotas. That has prompted a very angry response from some nations, most notably Slovakia. Its leader this week said that Slovakia will never accept such a quota, and that, in fact, such a measure will bring, in his words, the end of the EU.
Is this a pattern set in history somehow?
It is a pattern very much set in history, primarily, very recent history, within the decades after the Second World War. That was a time when the nations of Western Europe were rebuilding. They had issues of population decline, lack of manpower. And so they started inviting, in fact, workers, guest workers, they call them, from nations including Turkey, in the case of Great Britain, France, they and the Netherlands. Well, they drew from their former colonies. And so they have had time to assimilate and to they've been conditioned to accept these migrants. Whereas the nations of Eastern Europe do not have a history of accepting migrants. These were countries that lived under communist rule and where there was not the same level of development as there was in Western Europe. And so they are not as used to seeing migrants come in. Just to give you an example, there are only about 1% of the population of Hungary is foreign-born.
So what is the situation in the region today, Luis?
We continue to see a pretty substantial influx despite the border controls, despite actions by Hungary to seal its border to migrants coming in from Serbia. The police in Munich this morning told me that the rate is at 1,800 migrants coming in through this city alone every day since Monday. And so that is a slower rate than we had seen in days previous. For example, over the weekend, that is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there were 20,000 migrants coming through the Munich train station. What the German authorities are doing now is they are busing people to various parts of the country, doing everything they can to ensure that the migrants do not stay in Munich, do not linger here, and do not accumulate here as they had in days past. One of the reasons is that, we have another influx coming in, and that has to do with the upcoming Oktoberfest. That will last 2 weeks and will bring thousands of visitors to the city. Police being very careful, city authorities being very careful not to let the two groups mingle.
Well, thank you very much, Luis, for that report.
Thank you, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchewski with a look at what is being said today in social media. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. The top trending topic this afternoon in the U.S. and worldwide is hashtag I Stand With Ahmed. Now, let me explain this story. There's a 14-year-old boy, Ahmed Mohammed, in Irving, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas, Texas, here in the U.S. And on Monday morning, he went to school and built this digital clock that he was going to show his teachers. He's an engineering whiz. He does a lot with computers and circuits. So he built this clock, went to take it into his teachers, and the teachers assumed it was a bomb and had him just carted off to juvenile detention and where he was, you know, was arrested. And so this story has come out today, and it's sparked this social media outrage on two different levels. And it's kind of interesting how these two different groups have come together on this. You have on one end a lot of Muslim groups saying that this is Islamophobia. This is a student who is dark-skinned, was arrested. If this was a white student, this might not happen. If it was a student that wasn't named Muhammad or Ahmed Muhammad, this wouldn't have happened. So you have those groups weighing in on social media. And then you have the science and technology end of things. You have a lot of science educators, celebrities, scientists saying, why are we discouraging him from trying to do this kind of science and technology on his own time and be excited about that? This is only going to deter students from doing those kind of things. So,
and I saw this on TV, and it seems like the kid very innocently was just building this clock, and he was so proud of it. He wanted to show his teacher, and he innocently took it to school, and they thought it was suspicious looking. So you don't really know if it had anything to do with what he looks like or his religion or anything else. They just said it looked like a bomb.
Right, and it could very well be the school was being hyper-cautious, as many schools are these days.
Well, you've got to be
violence
careful,
against students.
And,
yeah, exactly. Ahmed's father saying that he thought it was racism, and a lot of people on social media chiming in and saying this is the state of things in the United States where students like this can't succeed, talking about the education in the United States and also some of the prejudices that people have in the United States. So whether that was the intention or not, that's how a lot of people are reading into it, and that's why it's a top trending topic, not just in the U.S., worldwide. This is the top trending topic, hashtag I Stand With Ahmed.
Well, it's interesting because it opens up a lot of conversations, and the kid is probably perfectly innocent, but it's got people talking about how cautious do we have to be?
Exactly. And this is a debate that's gone on a lot in the U.S.'s political correctness. And again, it brings in the education debate as well. It's on a couple of different levels that people are talking about this. But a lot of people saying that it's terrible that he was carted away. And the picture of him is actually trending after he was detained. He's wearing a NASA T-shirt in the National Aeronautics and Space Administration here in the U.S. So people saying that it's so sad that a kid who's so interested in science and technology gets carted off like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, I hope it doesn't discourage him, you know?
Hopefully not.
Yes. What else you got going?
We have also the GOP debate. Hashtag GOP debate is the 16, now there are 16 candidates. There were 17. Texas Governor Rick Perry dropped out of the race already. So 16 candidates running for the Republican nomination. Of those, 11 are going to be on the debate stage tonight at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California. So a lot of people wondering what's going to come of that, what key moments. They said after the last debate, Donald Trump kind of stole the show, so they're waiting to see who's going to maybe do that tonight and try to get some spotlight.
Well, we're going to have a report on that in just a couple minutes here on the show. So thank you, Andrew, for stopping by.
Yeah, thank you very much.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
There are lots of good reasons to quit smoking. Here's another one, keeping your teeth. A new study just published in the Journal of Dental Research shows that men who smoke are up to 3.5 times more likely than non-smoking guys to lose their teeth. Women smokers are 2.5% more likely to lose their teeth than non-smokers. According to the study's lead author, Professor Thomas Dietrich from the UK's University of Birmingham, most people lose their teeth from either tooth decay or gum disease, for which smoking is a risk factor. Smoking can also mask the effects of gum disease, so smokers may not realize the seriousness of their oral problems until it's too late and the teeth start falling out. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The major players in the Republican Party run for the White House face off tonight in a debate at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library near Los Angeles, California. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan is going to be in the hall and joins us on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Susan.
Say, what do you expect from the candidates?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of focus on Donald Trump because he's ahead in the polls. You know, this was a great surprise. Nobody expected this a month ago, but he's leading in the polls in the major early primary voting states, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina. And I think people are going to be, you know, the other candidates are going to be looking to him to make a misstep, to put his foot in his mouth, which is something he's done before. And, you know, it's basically he's got the momentum now, and people are just waiting to see if he can maintain it. And the opponents, the other candidates, are just looking for an opening to show that he does not have the experience to be the commander-in-chief or be the president.
Could the futures of some of these candidates be decided this very night?
Well, only if somebody makes a major misstep, I think, and that could happen. But for Donald Trump, the key is to not shoot from the hip as much as he often does, to make off-the-cuff comments and to be a little more measured so that he can hold up to some of the more polished political actors here. And I think only if somebody makes a major mistake is anything going to be decided tonight.
Okay, well, thank you, Mike, and I hope you have a good time tonight at the debate.
Okay, thank you, Susan.
The U.S. Federal Reserve kicks off a two-day meeting on interest rates today. So how are global markets faring? Business reporter Alexis Christophorus joins us on the line with some answers. Welcome, Alexis.
Thanks, Susan. Asian shares advanced with markets in China spiking in the final minutes of trading as the morale of investors got a boost from suspected intervention from Beijing and an overnight rally on Wall Street. China's Shanghai index rallied nearly 5%. Meantime, U.S. stocks seem to be holding their own as investors choose to wait on the sidelines ahead of the Fed's decision on interest rates due Thursday. And oil prices pairing some gains after the U.S. Energy Information Administration reported a fall of 2.1 million. Million barrels in crude supplies for the week ending September 11th. Susan?
Alexis, if the Fed does indeed raise interest rates this week, why should the rest of the world care so much?
Good question. And the short answer is the dollar. It is still the pillar around which the global financial markets revolve. Its monetary policy determines what happens to currencies, stock markets, and economies around the world. And some economists believe higher U.S. interest rates could trigger an exodus of capital from the emerging markets and cause chaos in already fragile capital markets. But actually, there are some reasons that the rest of the world, from Europe to Africa to Asia, should welcome a Fed rate rise. It would end uncertainty and, according to some economists, weaken other currencies. It would bring some flexibility back to American policymaking and make a return to normalcy. The markets are pricing in roughly a one-third likelihood of a rate rise this week. Even so, if the Fed remains on hold for September, the chances are it will finally make a move by the December meeting. The U.S. economy is steadily recovering. Jobs are being created, and it can most probably stand on its own legs without the crutch of 0% interest rates. Susan?
Thank you, Alexis.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, will you lose your job to a robot? And a great jazz host programs are archived. Robotics is increasingly seen in the workplace, especially in manufacturing, where, for instance, cars can be welded together and painted by robots instead of human beings. Now a new study from researchers at Oxford University in Britain says there are a number of other jobs, including white-collar positions, that could be taken over by robots. International Edition's Jeffrey Young joins us. And Jeffrey, what else did the study find?
Hi, Susan. Well, thanks to advances both in robotics and in the creation of algorithms, Oxford University researcher Michael Osborne says that people such as insurance adjusters and retail salespeople can be replaced by robots.
The outcome of our study was this finding that about 47% of current U.S. employment is at high risk of automation over the next 20 years.
What are the kind of jobs that could be automated and take humans out of the picture?
Due to advances in machine learning and mobile robotics is that it's not just kind of routine manual labor that's under threat, but increasingly cognitive labor. So what that means is that jobs like insurance appraisers, tax preparers, and even a lot of sales jobs are increasingly under threat.
I was reading in one publication that one aspect of automation that could be possible would be taxi drivers. Now that we have self-driving cars, just get in the cab and speak your destination, and this automated car takes you there. Really?
there has been remarkable progress in autonomous vehicles or self-driving cars. But I think what we'll see first is the automation of driving tasks that are relatively structured. So what that means is we're probably likely to see the automation of forklift drivers, people who drive agricultural vehicles or mining vehicles before we see taxi drivers automated away.
Now, you were talking about tax preparers and other white-collar workers. They could be doing the job instead of human beings?
That's right. So, I mean, obviously, algorithms are increasingly adept at not just storing information, but accessing it rapidly and even doing relatively subtle processing of that data. So it turns out a lot of traditionally white-collar jobs really just revolve around those sort of tasks. So we've already seen the automation of people like paralegal occupations, a bunch of other clerical occupations, and I mentioned before retail operations where the recommendation of products to customers can perhaps be better performed by an algorithm.
One thing that I was thinking about is the difference between a robot and a human being is that human beings can nuance in so many different layers. Is robotics capable of nuancing?
Where we've made progress in kind of bringing automation to even nuanced tasks is with the gathering of sufficiently large data sets. So to take one example, consider machine translation, which is the automated translation of written text from one language to another. So that's very much a task which you might have thought would require a lot of nuance, a lot of subtle understanding of cultural context. So the canonical example is that of the UN, which is required to translate its documents into six different constituent languages. Perform translation by, first of all, identifying a small phrase that they want to translate, finding in that corpus of documents, and then they can make use of those five immediate translations into different languages.
That was Oxford University Barton School Associate Professor Michael Osborne.
Well, I'm wondering, Jeffrey, did the study say that journalists are under threat by robots replacing them?
I guess we're lucky, Susan. The Oxford study says journalists have only an 8% chance of being replaced by robots.
Well, that's good news for now. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Susan.
Stop that. Okay, this is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Dementia affects some 35 million people around the world. Alzheimer's disease accounts for most dementia, but researchers in Europe say that large epidemiological studies are showing that the risk of dementia is decreasing as a result of dramatic changes in lifestyles. Dr. Laura Fertiglione with Sweden's Karolinska Institute says various factors can lessen the risk of dementia.
Non-smoking, moderate alcohol intake, physical activity, avoiding obesity, overweight, and doing all this starting from middle age.
And here's Professor Carol Brain at the University of Cambridge.
Older people are much more prone to changes in the blood vessels of the brain.
The researchers stress that there is no surefire way to prevent dementia, but anti-smoking efforts and healthier lifestyles starting at an earlier age are improving brain health. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
The late Willis Conover brought jazz and popular music to the world over our airways at VOA for more than 40 years. Now a new archive of some of his recorded programs is being made available to the public through the University of North Texas Library. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Maristella Futstill of North Texas about the archive and its significance in the history of jazz.
First of all, how did you come to know Willis Conover, and how did the University of North Texas start to store his programs?
Well, the collection was transferred quite a bit before my time. That transfer was made in 1997 through the Willis Conover Jazz Preservation Foundation, which was headed by Leonard Garment. And I arrived as a student at North Texas for the jazz guitar program in 2005 and started working in the music library in 2007 because it was a summer job that was quiet and air-conditioned. I quickly fell in love with library work, and that summer would have been the first time I asked somebody, who's Willis Conover, and why is his name everywhere in here?
And I understand that the collection has some of Willis's programs that include people like Louis Armstrong and Stan Getz and several other of the giants of jazz, and now it's being digitized from they were originally recorded on ferrous oxide tape, like reel-to-reel tape, and now it's being put up digitally, and it's being released to the public through the school's library, right?
Yes, the collection includes a treasure trove of interviews with jazz legends. We have Art Tatum in May of 1955. We have hours, I believe, of Louis Armstrong. We have Dave Brubeck, Kai Vinding, George Avakian. Those are among the early releases. And this came about from the almost 2,100 reels in the Conover collection through a Grammy Foundation grant that we got to digitize the most urgent preservation needs, which are the oldest tapes from about 1955 to 1969. And that's what's made it possible. And we've been able to get the first 10 online with many more to come.
And this is a unique opportunity for people. Many of these artists that Willis spoke with have passed on. And so this is a unique opportunity to hear them discuss what they do and why they did it the way they did, right?
Yes, it's an uncovered chapter in jazz history that we're incredibly excited to be finally making accessible.
There is also an effort afoot to have a stamp made for Willis from the United States Postal Service as someone who was an American pioneer or someone who was a citizen of note, right?
Yes, Willis certainly fits all of the criteria that the Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee states for eligibility to be on a stamp. Having had a tremendous cultural and historical impact in so many spheres, both musical, political, you name it. And so we put out an online petition, which wound up getting over 7,000 signatures.
That's David Byrd reporting from here in Washington. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early September, the U.S. Department of State named as designated global terrorists four men who pose threats to international stability. These designations mean that no U.S. citizen may trade or conduct business of any kind with these men. Also, it allows the United States to freeze their assets, lock them out of the global financial network, and prosecute them for terrorist activities. Samir Kuntar is a Lebanese citizen. In 1979, at the age of 16, Kuntar led four members of the Palestinian Liberation Front, a U.S. Department of State-designated foreign terrorist organization, on a mission to kidnap an Israeli family. The mission failed, and the group took as hostages of opportunity a young Israeli father and his four-year-old daughter. In the course of committing this crime, the terrorists willfully killed both hostages and two police officers. Two of the terrorists died. Kuntar was wounded, arrested, tried for murder, and found guilty. Kuntar was released from prison in 2008, was welcomed by Hezbollah, a U.S. Department of State-designated foreign terrorist organization, and has become one of the group's most visible and popular spokesmen. With the assistance of Iran and Syria, Kuntar has helped to build up Hezbollah's terrorist infrastructure in the Golan Heights. Three active operatives of the Hamas terrorist organization have also been designated global terrorists. Yahya Sinwar and Rawahi Mushtaha are founding members of the forerunner to the Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades, the military arm of Hamas. Their compatriot, Muhammad Deif, has participated in violent activities against Israeli citizens since the mid-1990s. He was involved in deadly bombings of civilian buses, kidnapped Israeli soldiers, and has planned and ordered numerous suicide bombings which have taken the lives of dozens of civilians. By naming Samir Kuntar, Yahya Sinwar, Rohi Mushtaha, and Muhammad Deif as specially designated global terrorists, the United States is taking a decisive step toward ensuring that they and the terrorist organizations with which they are affiliated find it ever more difficult to carry out their acts of violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.